Blog Talk Radio.
I'll be leading a discussion on angel magic, and that includes good spirits too, with an emphasis on crystal ball scrying techniques, training, equipment, and talisman construction and charging. Now, we'll discuss the recent books recounting Dr. Thomas Rudd's 17th century work in this field, and we'll relate some experiences we've had in the circle doing this work. Now, this will be call-in night. I want to emphasize that now. So have your questions, let me mangle that one up, questiones. So have your questions ready on any topic we've covered, and tune in and get theurgerated or thaumaturgified. Now, on the call-in number, and I want you to call in any time. Don't wait around for me to ask you to call in. Call in any time tonight, and the call-in number is 347-857-1830. Now I'll repeat that again. 347-857-1830. So, like I say, well, let's hear from you. And now, let's talk about angel magic and the kind of magic that we do with a crystal ball or an orb, if you want to call it that. And this is in the area that we generally refer to as invocation. Now, there's been some dispute about the meaning of invocation as opposed to evocation, and I don't want to get into that because it's essentially a theological, philosophical, psychological argument that people have. And let's just say this. The Shemi Hamfarash angels are very, very much a part of our modern tradition. Let me point something out on that. That, as all of you probably know, we have them on the back of all of our Goetia spirits, have the Shemi Hamfarash angel that corresponds around the wheel of the zodiac. That sigil's on the back side. And as you know, we use those angels to safety. We use them to safety the Goetia spirits, because the Goetia spirits in evocation are rebellious. I'm not going to call them evil, some of them are, but I mean, the Goetia spirits are rebellious. So we need these angelic spirits, which are more, they're more regulatory, and they're more positive, they're more in line with well, they're more like Boy Scouts than a bunch of hoodlums. You know, I mean, so what we use them on the back of the sigils. Now, the interesting thing about this is that, and I'm patting myself on the back here a little bit. Stephen Skinner gives me credit for learning this from Dr. Rudd. And in the Book of Solomon's Magic, of course, we have the Shemi Hamfarash angels, and then we use them on the back of the sigils and all, and then we explain all this. And we have them in the Master Mandala. We have them right linked up, so they're all, you know, linked up in one system. Now, Steve Skinner said, oh, well, you know, Pope Runyon, he's following Dr. Rudd in this. Well, I didn't know I was following Dr. Rudd. I came up with this all by myself, because I thought it was a good idea, you know. I mean, hey, we got these 72 angels running around, and then we have 72 Galatian spirits, and they both run around the zodiac, so why don't we use them together, and we could use them as a controlling factor and a safety factor for the Galatian spirits. So I came up with this all by myself, and I started doing it. And then come to find out first let me say this. So I did that. So Aaron Lettich comes out with this article and says, oh, this is wrong, you shouldn't use these Shemaiah Emperor's angels of the Galatia. They have no connection with the Galatia. On and on and on and on and on. And, you know, I was feeling kind of like, oh, gosh, I'm sorry I yelled at what I did, but I thought it was a good idea.
And then I come to find out that Thomas Rudd was doing it, and three other Galatian magicians in those days, 400 years ago, were doing it. Joe Peterson came out with his really beautiful Lamegaton, you know, the only Lamegaton you'll ever need. And we discovered this. And so, Aaron is right. They are two totally different systems as far as derivation is concerned.
Because the Shemaiah Emperor's angels, as most of us know, were derived from those three verses in Exodus, which just happen to have 72 letters and all that. But what happened was, this is way back about 400 or 500 years ago, some Goetic magician looked at those 72 angels and said, aha, and did the same thing. And then the rest of the Galatia magicians picked it up, and we've been doing it ever since. So, we stole them fair and square. And if we stole them 400 years ago, that means they're ours now. And they work very, very well. But you can do them, the Shemaiah Emperor's angels, you can do them on their own right. You don't have to be connected with the Galatia necessarily. You can go ahead and call them up or call them down, and they are really, really wonderful, and they do a lot of great things for you. You know, like let's see, Aziel does. He helps keep promises and obtains the friendship of the great, and he dominates good faith and influences sincerity and faith. And then Aladiah helps hide secrets and dominates plague and rabies, too, in case your dog bites you, and influences healing. So, you know, you can do a lot with these angels. Now, let's talk about how we do angels and so-called good spirits as opposed. Now, you know that we have this business of the rebellious spirits and the not-so-good spirits, the fallen angels or whatever. We do those in a process called evocation. And evocation, we say that it means drawing things out of yourself. Now, that doesn't mean that it's just strictly in your subconscious, because it links up to the universal mind and it has a far greater and a deeper reach than just yourself. But essentially, you're bringing them out of yourself. And so evocation, we use a circle, and the circle is inviolate. Then we prop a triangle up and put the dark mirror or speculum in the triangle, and we stare at the triangle, and we stare at this dark mirror and get our reflection seen through the sigil which we put on the mirror, and you know what happens. And our reflection fades out, and the spirit comes in, and we have a contact. Now, that's evocation, and that's where you put the spirits that are, they're rebellious, or they're not so good, or they're not holy angels particularly. Quite frankly, this is all a dualistic value judgment that really in this modern day, defining evil is not this. We don't define evil the same way as they defined evil back in the Middle Ages. We certainly don't. But that evocation is, still you can say that these spirits are related to rebellious aspects of your psyche, and therefore you want to handle them with this kind of system. Now, on the other hand, angels. Now, I want to say, I tell you honestly that I don't think all angels are all that good. I mean, the angels are very powerful, and some angels, if you're into angelology, especially if you have Davidson's Dictionary of Angels, and everybody's got to have a copy of Davidson's Dictionary of Angels. I mean, that's standard work. You'll realize if you go through Davidson, some of these angels are pretty ferocious. I mean, just because they're angels, and I think probably more savagery has been done under the aegis of the Archangel Michael than probably Asmodeus. Still, the angel is essentially a messenger of God, and an angel is in charge of various natural forces. And although the angel may not personify a natural force the way a pagan god does, the angel rules the balance of the force, as it were. So when we started our system off back in 1969, 70, when it started, I was very much influenced by Franz Barden and at that time. And I understood that Western magic, really Hermetic magic, is defined by these five elements: air, earth, fire, water, and spirit, that holds them together. And of course, these are the old elements that Empedocles, declared way back in 500 BC, and then he went and jumped in the volcano, and we haven't heard from him since. But these four elements plus spirit are what Hermetic magic is really all about. And don't just take my word for that. You know, you read the first chapters of Initiation into Hermetics, and Barden drives that through time and time again. Now, what we wanted to do is to personify these elements, the positive aspects of these elements, as angelic forms. So in the OTA, we have a really strong emphasis on air, earth, fire, and water. Air is Raphael, earth is Auriel, water is Gabriel, and fire is Mikael. And we put them around the quadrants. They reinforce our circle. We establish our circle with a modified Golden Dawn pentagram ritual where we establish these angels at the quarters. Now, we also personify the gender of the angels according to the nature of the elements. So this means that Mikael and Raphael are masculine. That's air and fire, and Gabriel and Auriel are feminine, and that's water and earth. And of course they represent the Grail Hallows. They represent the tarot emblems and the Grail Hallows. Michael has the lance. Gabriel has the cup. Auriel has the shield or the platen, and see who am I forgetting here? Raphael has the sword, and that's the sword of wisdom that separates. Now, in our tradition, of course, these angels also they do double duty or triple duty. They also live in the various spheres of the Tree of Life. Gabriel is in charge of the lunar sphere, and Raphael, Trithemius, you never could figure out whether he wanted to put Raphael in Tippereth or whether he wanted to put Michael in Tippereth, and so we just went along with the Golden Dawn and put Raphael in Tippereth and Mikael in Hod and Auriel in Malkuth. More or less in Malkuth. We also have St. Alphine down there. So we have all of our system is really coordinated with these four archangels and the spirit. Now, our master mandala, which links up the Shemehan Farash angels with the Galatia spirits, that's all set up in quadrants where each one of these archangels is overall And whatever you're doing in a quadrant of the circle is really under the aegis of that particular angel. Now, angels are creatures of light. Now, we can personify them, and we have, as Michael George has these beautiful paintings of these angels. My angel figures are a little simpler because I set my angel figures up to give people a basis for visualization, and so I didn't. I made them simpler artwork. So you can personify an angel with wings and make it male or female or whatever. And angels are not necessarily male or female. They're kind of androgynous. And if the truth be known, an angel appears in the form that you want to see the angel in, and the angel wants you to see him or her in, if they actually want to show you that form. Now, an important point I want to make here is that angel magic in a crystal, using a crystal ball, angel magic, you don't have to see a physical type representation of the angel. Now, you really don't, because an angel is a creature of light, and so you consequently you don't. You it's not necessary for you to see this little figure walking around on the top of the altar or floating around inside the crystal ball. That's not necessary. And in fact, some people do. Some people they have that kind of clairvoyance, and they do. They see a face in the crystal, or they see a full figure in the crystal. And Ian Kelly, I mean, they even had him walking around on the altar top. But you must understand that an angel is God. You're bringing it down, and it's God's messenger, and it's a creature of light. So it is not necessary to see it in a personified form in order to have a very powerful contact and a very powerful visionary experience, and I'll explain that in a minute. Now, the operative technique is a combination of scrying and ceremonial hypnosis, where you're bringing yourself to a state of ecstasy, of trance ecstasy, by chanting, and you're staring at this crystal, and the optical phenomenon here again will occur. The way we do this is that we sit on a low stool and we stare up at the altar top. Now, the reason why we stare up at the altar top is because when you stare up at something, you're automatically closer to a trance state. I learned this from Jose Silva's book on mind control. He probably learned it from somewhere else, but I found out with kind of a bit of experimentation that looking up at a crystal ball from a low position is really far better than staring down at it or staring straight at it. And then what we do is we have an altar top that has these little enclosures like horns around the sides. Most of you have seen it in one of our videos. They have little enclosures that hold the candles and reflect them inward. And so we can have four people sitting around the altar staring up at the crystal, and with four candles in these little enclosures, all pointing in toward the crystal. And then we have slots around the crystal, around the circle. We have these four slots, and the incense comes up from a chamber in the bottom, and the incense comes up and floats up around the crystal, and the lights reflect on the crystal. And if this is set up correctly, the other people around each have an equal view of the crystal, but they're not intruding on each other's view. Now, this is tremendously effective. If you are you don't have to be clairvoyant. If you do your minimum of yoga training of what we call Tradakam yoga, in other words, if you spend a week or so, you know, few about 10 minutes a day staring at a fixed object and in a meditative state. Train yourself to focus on a fixed object and not think about anything. Then you will have the right mindset, and then this will work absolutely beautifully. And this is, by the way they did it in the old days. And I'm gonna establish that beyond any doubt, because you know, people say, oh well, you know, you guys are inventing all kinds of new stuff. Now I want to read you something from years ago. Adam McLean published A Treatise on Angel Magic by Thomas Rudd, and Thomas Rudd was the successor to John Dee in the early 1600s, and Tom Rudd wrote in this Treatise on Angel Magic, he said, "The signs of appearance, both of good and evil spirits, are and ought to be carefully and well observed by reason they are foregoers of such an appearance, and whereby are known the differences thereof, which is a matter of material consequence, and shall be more plainly showed forth. Good angels, if good angels or elemental powers of light, or otherwise dignified spirits of benevolent or symbolizing nature with the celestial powers, and allied to the welfare and preservation of mankind, are moved and called forth to visible appearance in a crystal stone or glass receiver, as one usual way or customary form is among the learned magicians, then the sign of their appearance most seemeth like a veil or curtain or some beautiful color hanging in and about the stone or glass, as a bright cloud or other pretty kind of hieroglyphical show, both strange and very delightful to behold." Now there it is, because absolutely what Tom Rudd has just written there 450 years ago is exactly what happens when you stare up at that crystal on that altar, and you've been chanting, "Raphael, Raphael, 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 Raphael," and then the aura, it's a beautiful gold color with a deep violet, a deep electric violet, with this beautiful gold halo around it. And when that happens, you know you have a presence. You know you're on holy ground. Now, then the angel can speak through you, and I will, you know, I'll just go around the altar and say, "Soror so and so, does the angel speak through you? And she, if it does, then she'll start speaking. If not, she'll say, "Not at this time." Then I'll go to the next brother or sister around, and all the way around, and we'll quite often we'll have at least two people in the operation will actually channel, and we do this rather regularly. We do this quite often. So this whole channeling process is not something where you have to be a clairvoyant or you have to do, you can train yourself to do this. And now I want to point out something here, that using our methods today, using our yoga and our self-hypnosis training and operating the way we do today, if John Dee had known how to do this, if he'd known how to train himself to do this, he would not have had to hire Edward Kelly. And Enochian might have been quite a bit different than the way it was. In those days, magicians, Western magicians, didn't know how to do this. So they had to depend on clairvoyance. I mean, Abraham the Jew in The Magic of Amber Melon used a child. Well, today, if you did that, you took a child and put him through that kind of thing, you'd be arrested for child abuse. But they had no choice. They didn't know how to do it. And Coriostro, same way. This business of going out and getting clairvoyants or getting children to do this was because in those days they didn't have the technique. Now, the technique, as I said, it involves a combination of self-hypnotic training. Everybody that does this kind of work, evocation and invocation, should train themselves in self-hypnosis. And don't just do it with a tape recorder. Do it with your own voice. You need that loop. So you train yourself with self-hypnosis, which is good for you in any number of ways. I mean, self-hypnosis is good for your health. You use it for, you know, quit smoking. You can use it for a whole bunch of good things. But I think it's essential training for magic. Now, the other thing is, as I said, this type of pranayama yoga, which is a part of Raja yoga, by the way. Now, when we first started doing this, we based our Raja yoga program on Ramutri Mishra's Fundamentals of Yoga. If you can find that book, it's a great book. It went through a whole bunch of editions, but right now it's kind of difficult to find. It's called Fundamentals of Yoga by Ramutri Mishra, but it's essentially Raja Yoga. And he had a device in there called the Samadhi Lamp. So we built one of these things, and what it is basically just a shield that you put on a ceiling fixture. And you screw a blue bulb, not an ultraviolet, just a regular blue bulb, in a ceiling fixture. And then you hang this shield under it, a round shield, has a hole in it. And then there's, what we did was we just took an opaque, translucent cap from a spray paint can, put a black dot in the middle of it, stuck that in there, and then you lay under this thing and look up at it. And it's very hypnotic, and we would just lie under it and look up at it, and this would get you into this job. It would serve the purpose of Trotacom training. Well, yeah, it does. And if you want to build one, fine. And I've got a description of it in the Book of Solomon's Magic, and you can lay under that. That'll teach you without any verbal instruction. That'll teach you how to do this, but a lot of people can't do that, don't have overhead fixtures, and it's a lot of work, whatever. So we've been using recently a Raja Yoga technique that we learned from Oberon Silesio, this pearl, where we sit and we put a little imitation pearl down on a little piece of black felt, and we sit in a nasana and we just stare at it. And you stare at it. You don't think anything. You don't let the pearl play games with you. You just stare at the pearl. And you try to stare at the pearl for 5 minutes without having any kind of interruption, any kind of thought coming in, and especially you don't want to think about a hippopotamus. I mean, that's a dirty one. That pull that one on your students. Yeah, but you stare at that pearl, and you stare at it long enough, and you keep it up long enough, and all sorts of strange things will start to happen, but still, that's good training for staring at the crystal ball, and of course also the dark mirror. Now, the altar itself that I was mentioning, you really don't have to have this elaborate setup to do this kind of work, but all you need, basic bare bones, is a good crystal ball or even a good clear glass ball will work fine. We used a clear glass ball for years, and it works very, very well. Now we have one of these Madagascar rock crystal balls that's multifaceted and all that. That's fine, too. But you need a good glass or crystal ball in a dragon, those little dragon stands, and you need and an incense burner and a couple of candles, and a nice altar cloth, and really that is all you really need. However, if you want to experience this, really, really experience this, I think at optimum, you should have the incense coming up around the ball, and you should have the ball, you should have the altar top elevated, and those horns on the altar reflecting the light inward. that creates a marvelous effect. And so I would suggest that you look carefully in the Book of Solomon's Magic. We have plans for that altar top. You don't have to build that big double cube. We now have a couple of interlocking slats that are a lot more portable and a lot easier to use. Think about building an altar top that does that. And it's not that difficult. You don't have to be as elaborate as ours. I think that this is the way you should start before you get into evocation with a mirror and all. You should actually. And, you know, in the OTA, we make everybody, all of our first-degree people, they all have to do each one of these angels. They have to do each one of the major four archangels of the elements, and they have to do a successful evocation, get the angel inside and make contact with the angels, and that is one of our requirements before they can go into the Goetia program in a second degree. Now, relating some experiences, and I said that we were going to relate some experiences we had at Crystal doing this work on it. One of the best ones I think I could mention is we're talking about the Shemi Hamfarash angels. So I remember the time we did Vahuya. Now, Vahuya is the opposite spirit, that's number one, and he is opposite to Ma'il, who is Baal, of course, in the first of the Goetia. So we did Vahuya, and we did him on the Almadel altar, on our altar. And when I channeled him, I asked him, when we had the contact, and it was a good, strong contact, and I asked him, I said, what's really the difference? What's the real difference between you people, or you and the Goetia spirits? What's the major difference between the two of you? And he came back and said, they are the knowledge. We are the wisdom. They are the art. We are the power. Now, I could never have come up with anything like that. It's not that I'm incapable of it. It's just that it's just not something I would say. And I got to thinking about it later, and I realized this is, oh, boy. I mean, he really nailed it right there. We got another call. Oh, you're on the air, Sir Hermetic Hour. Who am I speaking with?
Yes, this is Emmanuel from Brooklyn. How are you tonight, Polk?
Well, I'm on a roll here with angels. what's your question?
Oh, yes, I didn't mean to break your train of thought. It's actually related to angels. It may seem a little bit off-the-cuff different, but I also, study, other systems of mythology from around the world, and I'm not sure. Are you familiar with the four great classics of China?
Well, a little bit. Tao Te King and whatever, but I'm not really that much. I'm not that much into Chinese magic. I've got
it on my list of things to really get into one of these days. But no, I'm really not. I know that Crowley really liked the I Ching, and Steve Skinner does too. You want to relate that to?
This is something that I'm still researching myself, but you may find interesting. One of the four great Chinese classes, the second one is called the translation has a couple of names, Outlaw of the Marsh or Water Margin or All Men Are Brothers. It's a story that's based on real historic facts, and it became canonized as a story about a rebellion that took place against a corrupt government where 108 warriors rose up and they raised an army to fight the government. Now, this is the part that gets really interesting that relates to the topic you discussed last week on magical astrology. That 108 was broken up into, of the chief warriors that raised the army, was broken up into two groups, and one of the groups was called the 36 Heavenly Chiefs, and the other group was called the 72 Earthly Fiends.
Yeah, well, it sounds like the 72 might have a astrological, magical significance. You know, they have 72 jinn, the 72 genies from the Arabian tradition.
Exactly.
And, of course, we have the 72 angels of the Shemei HaMefarash, and we have the 72 Goetia spirits. 72 is a number that, you know, that really relates to the zodiac, so it's kind of a universal, idea there.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because one of the critical or like notes I read in relation to that story is that many of the warriors that like fought to like in the rebellion and helped raise an army, a lot of them, this is the part that's very interesting, a lot of them that was demons that reincarnated into these mythological human forms.
Yeah. This sounds like it's a little bit further away from what we're doing, but I think there are are you into Carl Jung at all?
Oh, yes, I love Jungian.
Well, yeah, see, what I'm saying is that these archetypes, at a certain level, these archetypes are universal. And what you've got here is a synchronicity. Along that line, Stephen Skinner has this terrific book, The Complete Magician's Tables. And he's got, because he is into Chinese magic, he has all kinds of Oriental correspondences in here, too. This is about 777 taken to the third power. I mean, it's really good. I strongly recommend it. And for this business of checking these cross correspondences, so check that out if you would. The Complete Magician's Tables by Stephen Skinner, and I think you'll find a lot of really really interesting information in there. Anyway, I got to get on and wrap this up. So thanks for calling.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Yeah. Okay, right, bye. One of the things that that you have, of course, in the business of magical invocation around the double cube altar, is that the angel will appear and will speak differently to each person. This becomes it's the same angel, but it'll have a different message or a different projection for each of the people around there. So you get let's say you have four people scrying, four people in the invocation operation. You're going to have four different impressions of what the angel is saying. Although it may be all along the same line, probably will be. This gives the personal and the transpersonal aspect of it, and so you get it all. Now, this channeling process, one of the things that's important to it, if you train yourself in self-hypnosis, it makes it much, much easier for the angel to just start speaking with your voice. It makes it far easier to do that because you've already trained. You've already talked back and forth to your subconscious in your self-hypnosis training. Makes it much, much easier to do this. You have to, of course, understand that sometimes the voice will change. Sometimes the angel will sound different than your voice. Sometimes it won't. Sometimes it'll just use your voice as your voice. But it doesn't change the fact that this is an actual channeling, and it actually and also I want to point out, and I want to reiterate again and emphasize that it is not necessary. It is not necessary to see the angel's face or the angel's form in the crystal. Not with angel magic. We go for visions in the mirror, but not in angel magic. That. The angel is a creature of light, as a creature of tremendous power, and you're going to the crystal ball is going to do marvelous things. It's difficult to describe how beautiful it will be and how powerful it will be, but you don't need to see the angel's face. See, you can if you do, that's fine. Now, I mentioned here in our abstract that we were going to discuss talisman construction and charging. Well, we're going to have to briefly do that. Now, this is one of the practical aspects of angel magic. Now, you get the famous
everybody's famous talisman book, Mather's version of the Key of Solomon.
You get this and find your talisman and trace your talisman out on vellum or on parchment paper. And then when you get your talisman, and you can use Kameas for planetary spirits on this too. Now, the planetary spirits are very, very powerful, very old, very powerful, but the intelligence is the good guy, supposedly, and the spirit is the not-so-good guy. It doesn't matter. Do them in the crystal. Do them. It's a planetary spirit. You can do it in the crystal. And Stephen Skinner and I agree on that. There are some, this idea that they all have to be good is not necessarily true, as long as they're planetary spirits or angels or whatever, you can do them in a crystal. Now, when you do this, the talisman, Kamea or the Solomonic out of the Key of Solomon or whatever, combination of the two. I like to do the combination of the two. I do a Solomonic out of the Key of Solomon on one side, and I do the Kamea on the other side. And then you put that, you slip that talisman right under in those dragon stands that you can get at the occult shops, that they're perfect for just slipping that talisman right inside there so that the crystal reflects down on it. And then when you ask the angel, of course, to charge the talisman. And you can also, if you want to make the talisman more yours, you can put a little drop of blood on it if you want to. Or a little drop of something else or whatever, and you can make that personalizes the talisman. Now, the light comes down and reflects on the talisman, the incense comes up, and you're actually charging that talisman with the purpose of your operation. The angel is charging it for you. This is very, very, very effective, and we've had some really wonderful results with that. And I want to encourage you that this, another thing I want to leave you with this thought, that Goetia is exciting and sometimes a little bit scary and it's very dramatic if you do it, full ritual style and all of that. However, in the long haul, as a magician, you are going to find that crystal ball on that altar is where the real power is and where the real inspiration is. I sometimes jokingly say that I'm a crystal ball junkie, but I think that if one of those invocations done properly, the right planetary hour, the right planetary day, the right phase of the moon, the whole, get everything right, get the right spirit and all, and this can be so powerful that it is more powerful and certainly more insightful than any psychedelic trip you could take. So I want to leave you with that this is really the high point, as far as I'm concerned, of visionary magic. This is the highest element of visionary magic. And now, next week, we'll also have call-ins. Next week we will have call-ins again. And next week we're going to review and hit the high points on all of the programs that we've done thus far. We're going to take all of those subjects and we're going to just generally review them. And the reason why I'm going to do this is that I want you folks to be able to be aware that we are archiving these programs. This is a little mini magic course. So we're going to discuss what we've done at each one of these shows and say a little bit about it. And encourage you to go back and to go into the archives and listen to them. So next week, be sure to call in next week, too. We appreciated the call-ins tonight. And we'll see you next week, and we will review our whole program up to this point. And then we'll start again the following week with a new topic. And so until next week, good magic, and we'll see you then. Bye-bye.